This is day two of the 2012 Palm Springs Bible School. Our second period teacher is Brother Jim Stiles. His general subject is training to become equal to the angels, and today's topic is the power and authority of the angels. Brother Jim.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning. Actually, Dave was wondering whether I'd mind if we got started before the seats were filled. I was surprised that there were so many seats filled yesterday when people found out I was speaking. I warned Jeff, when you have a local speak, you just never know whether there's anybody going to show up at all. It's just like, why go all that way to hear him? Plus, we can just download those classes online anyways, right? Oh, yes. Now, what we'll do is we'll just, I just keep track of when we get started, and we'll take every minute that we have to wait to get started. We'll take that off the water aerobics time tomorrow morning. How's that? Then you'll never show up. All right. Yeah, maybe I'll be there. I'll be there watching Sue out in the water. She's good at it. I have the towels all ready to go when the people come out shaking. Yeah, the low tonight's 39. For all you Canadians, you think it's hot, right? Yeah, no, 39 Fahrenheit. Okay. Yes. Angels, I made an executive decision yesterday because usually I do these classes in six. We only have five this week. In fact, actually, Jane mentioned after the class yesterday, she said, well, now that you've covered all the passages on angels, what are you going to do the rest of the week? And, well, there's actually a few more to go. So I decided to throw in some of the things on Zechariah today because Zechariah, I love it. And I usually cover it in class six. So hopefully we'll have some time to look at Zechariah this morning as well. You may not think of Zechariah as a place to go to for angels, but you might be surprised there's more revealed about angels in Zechariah than any other minor prophet. And it's just something, it shows us how we read over things and we don't even notice them. And hopefully today we'll get a chance to look at those. So that's the goal. Today we're going to look at the power and the authority of the angels as we go along and hopefully get a feel for the power and the authority that God invests in them. And again, the perspective of this is that we're doing this is job shadowing. This is what God is offering us when he offers us the kingdom. These are the things that we have to look forward to as members of the family of God. So to get started this morning, what we're going to do first is lay some ground rules about angels as to why they show up so much more often than we may think. And the basis for this is having a look at the link of the Hebrew word Elohim and the use of the angels. And in that passage that you referred to when you're looking out of Psalm 104, and Paul quotes that in Hebrews, he actually inserts there the word angels, sometimes where our Bibles may have said God. And this is where you pick this up. So in Psalm 8, for example, just to give an example of that, when in the RSV there it says, "What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? Yet thou hast made him a little less than God." Because that's actually the Hebrew word Elohim right there. Just the common Hebrew word that's translated God in the Old Testament. And does crown him with glory and honor. Well, in the New King James, or in your King James Bible, you probably have there. Most of our other versions, they put in the word angels. Made him a little lower than the angels. Now, why do they do that? Why would they all of a sudden take a passage that's clearly Elohim and put in the word angels? Well, the reason is some of the Bible translations, the translators figured if the New Testament writers realized when they look back at the passage that this was the angels, then they went ahead and put it in the Old Testament. So they did that here, and they're basing it on Hebrews 2. When Paul quotes this in Hebrews 2, that thou hast made him, you have made him a little lower than the angels, then Paul puts in the Greek word angelos there instead of using the word for God, theos. And so Paul's authority there, the apostolic authority by inspiration, is that that's who actually was referring to back in Psalm 8. Now, you might think that's a blip on the radar screen, but actually it occurs more than once because Paul does it again. In Hebrews 1, when he quotes that passage there, and again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, which is not when Jesus was born, but that's when he again brings the firstborn into the world, some of the modern versions have it correct. He says, let all the angels of God worship him. So not at his birth, but at his rebirth, when he was resurrected from the dead and given the name that's above every name, that now even the angels are subject to him. That is actually pulled out of Psalm 97, where it said, worship him, all you gods. Now, I think probably most of your versions put in the word gods there, because they didn't realize that it was actually picked up by Paul in Hebrews 1, and didn't realize that it was actually the Elohim that's there. At least they put in gods, but it's actually the angels there. So it's worship him, all you angels. Actually, it was really nice that Johnny, I got to thank Johnny for being, it's nice to have a younger person here to give classes because, you know, you go so fast, Johnny, which is so nice. Usually, I get all done with a class and Sue has to tell you that, anybody tell you to slow down yet? And but by you leading off the morning, you get everybody going on such a good spirit. We're ready to roll. And I got to thank you for that. So that's what happens in teaching high school for years, and you have all those teenage kids sitting there. Their brains are so fast. You keep up with them and keep them busy, or else they're doing something else while they're listening to you. And that's what they tend to do. So we might whip through the passages a little fast today, but that's okay. I also will offer to all of you who can't take notes real fast, you have the tapes, CDs, all those things. All of you that have grandchildren that know how to operate these little guys, you can maybe take those home and they'll show you how to open them up. All the PowerPoints will be on here, and I'll just leave it sitting out all week up here on the table so you can help yourself and put those on your iPads and your laptops and whatever else you have. Or you can just wait and download them. That's fine too. All right, now, with that in mind, that the word Elohim is used there about angels, and very clearly is picked up by Paul as being angels, you have to be careful when you're reading through the Old Testament. This is what a study of the angels does. And all of a sudden, you start to realize that angels were there a lot more often than we thought. So in Exodus 3, in the burning bush passage, as he refers to it as, the angel of the Lord appeared in Exodus 3 to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So we know very clearly it was an angel of the Lord. And Moses looked, and the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. And he turns aside to see it. And in verse 4, the Lord saw that he turned aside to look. God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." So he said, "Don't draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground." Moreover, he said, now, this is the angel calling out of the bush. And he says, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." For Moses hid his face. He was afraid to look upon God. Now, I remember as a young person, I read through those passages and I thought, wow, God really came down. He left heaven and he's there talking to Moses out of the bush. And you know, here he is calling to Moses. Then you start to realize, wait a minute, God doesn't come down to earth. He doesn't really come down. He sends his representatives. He sends the angels. So in this case here, you have an angel who stands there. Could have been Michael. Could have been another angel with great authority. And he stands there and he speaks on behalf of God. Brothers and sisters, this is what God offers you. This is what it means to be a part of the family of God. You come to represent God to the people that you will deal with in the future. This is what he entrusts his family members with his angels. He entrusts them and he gives them missions like this and sends them down to talk to the people. And in this case, you read this and Moses is afraid to look at God. And so the Lord said, this is the angel talking with him, "I've surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt and heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows." So he's well aware of what they're going through. "So I have come down." I see, you know, there's the angel. The angel is represented as coming down, you know, because they're trying to help us understand what it is to leave heaven and actually come to earth. And the best thing they can do is explain it in the sense of coming down out of the sky as to what it really is, probably a different dimension of some kind. That's actually what really happens. And he came down to deliver them from the hand of the Egyptians. So in Exodus 19, now we've left Egypt and they're coming out and they're coming to the mountain. All right, in Exodus 19, Moses brings the people out of the camp to meet with God. All right, actually, this fits in with the exhortation the other day when you're going through the tabernacle. What God had intended was that the people would actually meet him at the mountain. And unfortunately, the community couldn't handle it. And everything that happened here in Exodus 19 and 20, the people just kept getting pushed further and further away. They couldn't handle being that close to God. In fact, what ended up happening is that Moses had to take the tent, he calls the tabernacle, it's on Exodus 24, and he pitched it outside the camp because God couldn't dwell in their midst because he would consume them at that point. And then when that tabernacle was finally put up in Exodus 40, then God had barriers put up between his dwelling place and the people. And this is what the law did. The law, in the end, separated the people from God. This is how Paul picks this up when he wrote to the Galatians, and he writes in Hebrews, that the law tended to push the people away because it made sin appear more exceedingly sinful. Whereas God had intended to dwell with the people. That's what he actually wanted. So when Moses brought the people out to meet with God, they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. So the angel comes down at that point, and look what the angel does. The angel puts the mountain on fire, has the smoke that's there, the thunder, the lightning. You find out in the Psalms that were occurring at this point in time, and the whole mountain quaked greatly, and the angel spoke to the people. But when you read Exodus 20, it simply says that God spoke all these words, saying, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." Now, in case you know you think I'm taking a little bit of liberty here of realizing this is an angel, look at how Stephen refers to this when he's recounting this to the children of Israel. In Acts 7, at verse 38, he talks about the Moses, the same Moses that you reject right now. It was he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us. So we know very clearly it really was an angel that came down. An angel had talked to Moses, talked to the people, and the angel presented himself. This is representation. He presented himself as, "I am the God of your fathers, and I am the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt." You find in Judges 2, when they're finally in the land, all right, and the angel comes and meets with them, and he meets with them up at Bochim, and he says in Judges 2 at verse 1 there, that the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, "I led you from the land of Egypt and brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you." This is clearly, it's an angel of the Lord who's actually presenting this, because he's speaking on God's behalf and told them to make no covenants with the inhabitants of the land. Verse 3, "I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they will be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel that the people lifted up their voice and wept." Their voices, and they wept at this point. But here's an angel reminding them that, look, I've been with you. I'm the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And this angel that brought them out of the land of Egypt, Moses developed a personal relationship with this angel, which is really interesting to watch. Somebody asked me just this morning whether I think that any of us have angels who actually are assigned to us, whether we actually have a personal angel. And if you're looking for biblical hints on that subject, you look for people that actually happened to. It's not a guess. It's like, what does the Bible say? And you know very clearly that Moses had a relationship with one specific angel, the angel that he talked with face to face. You know of any other people that had a relationship with an angel? Who we got? Daniel, right? Who came to Daniel all the time? Gabriel. Gabriel kept coming to Daniel. Daniel 8, Daniel 9, it actually specifically says it was Gabriel that was sent to talk to him. We also know with Jacob. Jacob, the man who wrestled with an angel and wouldn't let go of him. Well, you'll find Jacob knew that angel really well. And heck, he knew him so well, he pleaded with the angel at the end of his life to stay with the family and work with his grandchildren. It's a fascinating thing to watch that these people knew angels and they knew them so well and they trusted them that they wanted them to stay with the family. That's the kind of relationship that they had with these angels. For us, it's not like that today. You know, the angels are more like ants to us. They're out there doing God's work all over the place and we don't even know they're there. Unless you take a piece of candy and you like leave it on the kitchen table. You know, and when you watch all those ants piled on there in the morning, that reminds us that, yeah, the angels were really there. You just didn't know they were there. And all of a sudden they show up and they come to us in times when we need help. And all of a sudden we realize that they're there to help in time of need. So in Judges 2, this angel had showed up to remind them that he had brought them out of the land of Egypt. Now, if you go even back to the Garden of Eden, you know, we know the stories that are there. Genesis 3, that Adam and Eve heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife, they hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden because they had sinned. Now, when the Lord was walking through the garden, this was not God himself, the Father. This was his angelic representation. The angels that knew Adam and Eve, and they walked with them in the garden. And they had been there among Adam and Eve, and Adam and Eve would have known them. So when the Lord God called to Adam and said to him, "Where are you?" This was an angel talking to Adam at this point, because God entrusts his angels to work on his behalf. This is the authority that he gives them, the power that he entrusts these angels with. And this is what he offers us, brothers and sisters. This is the hope that we have of being a part of his family. This is what you see a little window into the angels. You get this little idea about what it's going to be like to live in the family of God forever and be a representative of the Lord God of heaven to the mortal peoples during the kingdom and beyond. This is what he lets them do. You find, throw in this section on Zechariah, because I just can't resist this, but Zechariah, of all places to go to, you might not think it's an area to deal with angels, but here's what happens in the story of Zechariah when you get to Zechariah's prophecy. You saw in Zechariah 1, remember the story about he sees the vision of the man riding on the red horse? And he stood among the myrtle trees in the hollow, and behind him were red and sorrel and white horses. So what do we got? Four horsemen, right? So here they are. They've come in. Now, what were these guys doing, the horsemen? Where had they been? They'd been out patrolling the earth, and now all the earth is resting quietly. They'd been out working. These were the angels who were going and accomplishing God's work of bringing the kingdom, the Persian kingdom, back under control. Because for a moment of time, it had gone to a little bit of unrest. And so in verse 9, he said, "My Lord, what are these?" And the angel who talked with me said, so Zechariah is talking with an angel. And he's having this discussion with an angel. And there's other angels out there. And you get all this interaction in Zechariah between the angels. So the man who stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, "These are the ones whom the Lord has sent to walk to and fro throughout the earth." These angels, they'd been out there patrolling, and they had brought stability back to the Persian kingdom. And you wonder, well, why is that? Well, remember what happened in the Persian Empire is that the Jews had gone back with Cyrus's decree to build the temple. Cyrus lasted another 6 years. They worked on the temple during that time. Started out excited. But as the years dragged on, the people became less interested. The Samaritans caused all that trouble in Ezra chapter 3. Remember, they stirred up the people against them. They wrote letters to the Persian king, tried to get him to stop. Cambyses came in, Cyrus's son, and reigned for another 8 years. And there was some work going on, but it was slowing down. And eventually, the people didn't want to work anymore. And so God finally gave them what they wanted. They wanted a break, and so Gomedes comes in. This guy was supposedly, he presented himself as the brother of Cambyses when Cambyses died, and he presented himself as the one who should take the kingdom at this point, only he was a fake. You go back into history, they call him Pseudo-Smertus because he really wasn't. He was a pseudo. He really wasn't Smertus, the brother of Cambyses. He was a fake that had come in, and they even wonder whether he had killed Cambyses. But what happened at that time? For 7 months, the Persian Empire was in disarray. People were rebelling on the edges of the empire. So in Ezra 4, when those people, when those Samaritans wrote that letter to Gomedes and they said, "Hey, you hear what these Jews are doing? They're rebuilding the city. They're putting up the walls. They're going to rebel." He panics and he sends the army in and says, "Stop building." And that's it. They're done. And then it took two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to stir up the people and get them going again. And so that's what they did. When you look at the timeline, they come in, Zechariah and Haggai, they come in the second year of Darius Hystaspes, and they start to stimulate the people. Because what the angels did is they brought the Persian Empire back under control. They instituted Darius Hystaspes as the king, got rid of the fake guy, brought stability back. They went out and patrolled the earth. They brought all the kingdom back to rest. And they come back and report in Zechariah 1, and they said, "We did it. We brought it all back under control. Everything's ready to go. Let's finish the temple." The angels. Isn't that interesting? You ever realize that they get excited about their projects? They've been given a mission to do? They're sometimes more excited than we are. And this is what you find out in Zechariah. The angels were more excited about finishing that temple that the people, the older ones, looked at and they said, "Oh, this is no good compared to what we used to have." These angels were excited about getting this temple finished, and that's what you'll see. So what God did at this time, when you look at the history of the family line here, Cyrus is right here, and his son Cambyses had reigned for a while. This guy that came in, they call Bediah right there, or Smyrtus, is possibly his brother. And this is the fellow that they think that Gomedes was trying to imitate, but he gets wiped out after 7 months. And then it changes over to a different line in the family. And this is when Adraeus Hystaspes comes in, who's the one in which the temple's finally finished. It's a really interesting period. But the angels orchestrated all of that back then in order to work in the kingdoms to accomplish all these things for the children of Israel. This is the kind of thing that angels are doing. So in chapter 1 of Zechariah, they answered the angel of the Lord, the one that had been patrolling and who had stood among the myrtle trees. And they said, "We've walked to and fro throughout the earth, and behold, all the earth is resting quietly. We're ready." Then the angel of the Lord answered and said, so now you have the angel of the Lord, who's now appealing to God because he'd sent his angels out to bring the earth under control. And they say to God, "Oh, Lord of hosts, how long will you not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah against which you were angry these 70 years? See, the angels did their job. They brought the earth under control. And they said, "We're ready to go. How long are you going to wait until we finally get this done?" And the Lord answered the angel who talked with me good and comforting words. And so the angel who spoke with me said, "Proclaim and say amongst to the people, thus says the Lord of hosts, I'm zealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with great zeal, and away we go." Now, you look at this and you try to understand from the perspective of angels. These angels were out there doing a job. They didn't know the whole plan. They knew about the 70 years, but they didn't know all the details of the plan. And this is what we're in for in the kingdom, brothers and sisters. We will not have all knowledge. When we reign as angels and we reign as kings and priests, our knowledge will be limited as well. We'll have the big game plan in mind that God has explained to us or that Christ deals with us. But some of the specifics along the way we will not be sure about any more than these angels were back here. So what happens in chapter 2 is that then he looks up his eyes and he looks and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. All right, so we got chapter 1, we're going to finish the building. The man runs out with the measuring line. He's going to measure the city. And he says, "Where are you going?" "Now I'm going to measure Jerusalem to see what its width and its length." And so this guy's excited. We're going to get building again. Let's go. And the angel who talked with me was going out, and another angel came out to meet him. So we had angels and angels. All these angels are interacting at this point. And one of the angels says to another, "Run and meet this fella. All right, go and speak to this young man and say, Jerusalem's going to be inhabited as towns without walls." "Oh, don't worry about getting the walls done. It's okay to finish the temple, but you don't need to build the walls yet because we are going to be the walls. We are going to protect the city." And this was really encouraging to the captives because some of them would have been wondering, is it the right time to finish the temple? Maybe we should be building the city instead. And all these things would have been going on in ecclesial life. And Zechariah has to explain to them, no, let's finish the temple. God will be the walls for us and he will protect the city. But look at how these angels work together. It's just fascinating to watch how they're like those ants that are out there working for the sake of the community, trying to get God's will done. And although they don't know all the details of the work, they're certainly out there helping along the way. Zechariah 3, he then sees, remember this is the chapter about Joshua the high priest. So he sees Joshua standing before the angel of the Lord. Here we go again, which we find out in Jude is Michael. All right, Jude actually refers back to this, and he actually draws a moral lesson for us about how this angel behaved here in Zechariah 3. Did you ever realize that? And that's what Jude does. He says, look, when we get into ecclesial debates and we get into confrontations, he says, look at angels who have greater authority and power than all of us. They don't sit there and chew each other out. They don't say nasty things about each other. What does this angel do? He says, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan." That's it, Jude says. That's all he said. Let God take care of it. And Jude actually quotes that as a good indication for us, brothers and sisters, that we shouldn't badmouth each other. We shouldn't derate each other. We simply take it to God in prayer. And God will take care of things. And he uses an angel. It's because this is how they behave. And he encourages the brethren and sisters, you should be behaving the same way. Because this is how angels behave, and they're much greater in power and authority than we are. And if that's how they behave, wow, we should at least follow their example and behave that way as well. All that here from Zechariah 3. So anyways, Joshua, he's clothed with the filthy garments representing the priesthood at that time and Christ and all the things that you know of here in Zechariah 3. But anyway, he's standing before the angel, and Michael then says to him and spoke to those before him, "Take away the filthy garments from him. You know, I've removed your iniquity from you and clothe you with rich robes," because at this time, Joshua was now being encouraged that as high priest, you're not going to be working on the walls all this time. We're going to finish this. We're going to change your clothes, and you're going to be in that temple operating as high priest again. This was the historical application back here in Zechariah chapter 3. So put the clean turban on his head. And the angel of the Lord, this is what they're doing. The angels are working at this point in this vision, cleaning up Joshua, encouraging him, "You will be high priest of this house. It's going to be finished and happen in your lifetime." Now, at the end of chapter 3, the Lord admonishes him and he says, "Look, you'll be my priest if you walk in my ways, if you keep my command. Then you shall also judge my house and likewise have charge of my courts, and I'll give you places to walk amongst those who stand here." You'll be walking amongst the angels, working in the house of God. And in verse 8 there, you have then, there's the other side. We have Joshua, the high priest. We have Zerubbabel, who's the king. And he says, "Look, I'm going to bring my servant, the branch." And he's going to set up, that was going to be the king aspect. So you have Joshua and Zerubbabel, the king and the priest, two separate people that couldn't be combined in the law, but representing Christ who would come. But at that point, my servant, the branch, was going to be Zerubbabel. And so in verse 9, the stone which I've laid before Joshua, this stone, it was the capstone, as it's called in modern versions. This was the final stone that was going to go up on the top of the temple when it was finished. And everything would be based on how that stone fit in there. And what the builders would do is they would look as they were building the temple and they'd find which one's going to be the best capstone. And they would set it aside, the stone which the builders rejected. Right? This is the one that in the end was going to finish the house. And so this capstone has 7 eyes that are on it. Now, a lot of times in our community, people picture the eyes and they think the eyes are actually on the stone, in the stone itself. Oh no. These eyes were the angels. And the 7 eyes were the 7 angels that were watching the stone and guaranteeing that it will go up into its place. This is what the guarantee was, that Joshua, you will be high priest, Zerubbabel, you will be the king at this point, you'll be the governor, and you will actually be there when this temple's finished, when God removes the iniquity from them at that time. Now, you find this out in Zechariah 4, because then the angel who talked with me came back and wakened him up, and he said, "Well, what do you see?" And he said, "I'm looking at a lampstand, solid gold with a bowl on it, and you got the 7 lamps, 7 pipes, the 7 lamps, and the 2 olive trees that are standing right there, the one on the right and the one on the left." And in verse 4, I answered and spoke to the angel who talked with me, and he said, "What are these, my Lord?" And the angel who talked with me looked at him, and he says, "Don't you know what these are?" It's like, don't you get it? The 2 olive trees. What are they? Well, they show up in Revelation 11, don't they? The 2 olive trees. All right? The 2 witnesses. You got Zechariah and Zerubbabel, and we got Joshua. We have the 2 witnesses then, the 2 that were going to finish this work, and it was going to get done. And so you've got the 2 there that he's dealing with in Zechariah 3 and in Zechariah 4, guaranteeing that the work will get done in their day. And so the angel goes on and talks to him, and he says, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. Now, Zechariah 4 is about Zerubbabel. "Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. What are these, O great mountain before Zerubbabel? You're going to become a plain and bring forth the capstone with shouts of grace. Grace to it." This was the final stone that was going to go up in these days when finally the temple was going to be built. Now, it's finished in only 4 years. That's all it took at this point. They started in the 2nd year of Darius, and they finished it in the 6th year. So all of this did get done by the 6th year of Darius Hystaspes. And he says at the end there, verse 9, "Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you." Now, look at verse 10. Think about this. "For who has despised the day of small things?" Oh yeah, back in Ezra 3, when they were putting up the foundation of the temple, and the older people and the younger people were there, and the younger people were all excited, "Yes, we're working." And the older ones were thinking, "Oh, this is nothing compared to what we had." And they were crying. They're crying. And Haggai says, what's the matter with you? You despise the day of small things. It looks small to you. Sure, maybe the witnessing effort today isn't as great as what we had before. Maybe when the young people plan something, it's not as big as what you had in your day. But the angels are excited about it. They're thrilled. This is the best you can do right now. Look at the response. For these seven, that's the seven eyes from chapter 3. They're rejoicing to see the plumb line and the hand of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of the Lord which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. They'd been out there and brought the whole earth under control again for the Persian Empire because they knew this would bring about the finishing of the temple. They were excited about their work, excited about their missions, and the human people of the time were depressed. They didn't want to get going on it. They were all discouraged and they were in despair. And brothers and sisters, sometimes you have to get into the shoes of the angels and realize that they are the ones in control. They're doing the work. We simply assist them in their work. And they will accomplish things far beyond what we are able to do. And these angels were excited. Don't despise the day of small things, but rejoice that the angels are out there working today. Now, although they're out there working, they certainly don't know it all. And it's fun to look at the limits of angels in terms of, like, what will God reveal to us in the kingdom age and beyond as members of his family. We find in Matthew 24 that Jesus told his disciples, of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven. They didn't know the day, but my Father only. Which really encourages me. There's no sense looking back in Daniel or anywhere else thinking you're going to find the day. The angels couldn't figure it out either. And there's no way we're going to figure it out. Even the Son didn't know, but my Father only. So there's game plans revealed, big events, but there's no specific days. If it was based on the patterns of the law, they would have figured it out as well. So it's just not there for us to find. In 1 Peter 1 and verse 12, you look back at these angels. To them it was revealed, the prophets in this case, that they were ministering to us. Things had been reported to you. And they were preached through the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven. Things which angels desire to look into. They don't know it all. They talk to each other. They try to figure it out. Imagine the discussions that go on amongst the angels, trying to figure out things that were going to happen. How is God ever going to save this race? We haven't been able to save a single person for 4,000 years. And they tried to figure it out. You know, what's he going to do? He's going to have a son. How's this going to work? And they tried to figure out, how are we going to bring the Gentiles in? How is this going to happen? And they talked with each other and tried to figure it out based on what they knew. But they don't know it all. They're not all-knowing like God is. He gives them enough information to make their life interesting and challenging, but he doesn't tell it all. Now, do you see why he doesn't tell it all? Imagine if they knew. The angel working with me or with you knows the end result. And they know we're going to fail. Or they know we're going to make it. Can you imagine how discouraging it would be to be assigned to work with somebody only to know that they're going to fail? That isn't how it works. We wouldn't want that in the kingdom. You wouldn't want to be assigned to a mortal and God tells you, I want you to work with Billy over here, but Billy's never going to make it. He's going to live long in the kingdom, 870 years, but you work with him all that time and in the end he's going to turn away. That isn't what makes life interesting and challenging. And this is what God has for us. So they probably don't know whether we're going to make it. And this is what makes life interesting for them. We definitely know that some angels are above others. They have in their community, a bit like ants, they have some that, like they got their queens, and they got a few others that maybe make some decisions. We've got the commander of the army of the Lord in Joshua 5. And we know in Jude 1 that Jude refers to this angel back in Zechariah 3 and calls him Michael the Archangel. So some angels have higher positions than others. But in the family of God, you see, you don't worry about that. You're so glad to be in God's family and be with somebody who you trust and know will make good decisions. They're willing to work with each other that way. This is how God's family operates. And it's okay when another angel has more authority than another one. They don't seem to have a problem with that. And they're very thankful that God only gives them jobs that they are able to handle. The Peter principle doesn't apply here, where you don't just work your way up to a point where you're frustrated the rest of your life. That isn't how it works. You got Daniel 10, hopefully Johnny will get there and have a look at Michael. He's one of the chief princes. And if the other angel there in Daniel 10 was Gabriel, then Gabriel's out there doing his job, trying to withstand the prince of Persia because the Persians were moving in too fast and he had to hold them off at this point. And he says, look, I was trying to work with this fella and it's a tough job. The Persians were pushing forward and they were ready to go. But then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I'd been left alone there with the kings of Persia. And so he gets help in this case for Michael. Isn't that fun to see, though, that angels work as team players like that? They help each other out. And they can get frustrated in jobs that they're assigned. They don't just have all power like God where they can just necessarily just accomplish everything they think about and, you know, snap their fingers and it gets done. Here, for 3 weeks he'd been working, 21 days, and the prince of Persia had withstood him there and he's working against him in this case. But it's fun to see that about the character of angels. Now, some of the fun things to look at in angels is how they operate with God. And I think we have a bit of a window into what actually happens in heaven. You find in Psalm 89, this is out of the RSV, because some of the other versions there, they missed it. And they thought it was the saints there. You read that in your Bible and you think, well, maybe that's human people. No, it's not human people. The saints here in Psalm 89 are actually those in the heavens. There is heavenly hosts. These are the angels. So let the heavens praise thy wonders, O Lord, thy faithfulness in the assembly of the holy ones. For who in the skies can be compared to the Lord? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Lord? So he's comparing the Lord with his heavenly beings, with the angels, a God feared in the council of the holy ones. Oh, isn't that interesting that he saw this as a God who's revered and feared in the council? They have a council of the holy ones. They get together, all the angels and groups of them, they get together in the presence of God and they rever God. They're there to help. They've been sent out by God. They're there to talk with him and find out what's the plan today. What is the big mission that we're out to accomplish? And God sends them out to do their job. Now, if you're wondering whether that's just like one passage, I think that gives you a window into what was going on with Ahab and Jehoshaphat. Remember this story when Ahab decided that Jehoshaphat came up to see him and he thinks, oh, good, we're going to get Jehoshaphat in on this. We're going to take back those cities that the Syrians had taken. And he just, in front of all the people, he just embarrasses Jehoshaphat. Hey, you got to help me fight against the Syrians? And he sort of like ropes Jehoshaphat into helping him out here when Jehoshaphat really shouldn't have been up there doing that. But anyway, so Ahab checks out with his prophets and he asks all the prophets of Baal, and yeah, let's go. And you can imagine it was like a high school pep assembly before the big game that night, and everybody's in the auditorium and they're all cheering it on. And sometimes in our school they used to do skits where they'd have like a group of people represent your school, another group represent the other school, and you'd come in, you know, you can imagine these guys coming in with their animal horses and they run the other guys right over and they're all pumped up, you know, and everybody's cheering on, we're gonna go beat these Syrians, and away we go. And Joshua says, don't we have any prophets of Yahweh around here? Well, we got one. He's in jail. Go get him, would you? And can you imagine if you were the fella sent to get Micaiah out of prison? And you're taught, you bring Micaiah out, you clean him up, we're going to bring him in front of all these people. You know, what is the word of Yahweh? We're going to clean him up. And all the way there, you're saying to Micaiah, everybody's pumped up, ready to go. Micaiah, you better give a good message. Micaiah, don't disappoint Ahab. You're going right back to that prison again, Micaiah. And, you know, he gets all the way there. No wonder he came in sarcastically and said, oh, sure, you're all going to win. You know, and right away Ahab knew, oh, come on, Ed, you're just being sarcastic. Tell me really what you saw. And look at what he saw in verse 19 of 1 Kings 22. I saw the Lord sitting on the throne and all the host of heaven standing by. These are the ones that stand by that we saw back in Ezra's time period there in Zechariah 3. And on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall at Ramoth-Gilead? See how this is how the heavenly council works. God says, look, here's the plan. Ahab's going to fall today at Ramoth-Gilead. What do you think? How are we going to do this? Isn't that interesting that God would actually talk to his heavenly council? This would be fun to be part of this. to be part of the heavenly council, working with God, working with other angels that all work together, a team of people who are all on the same game plan, and they're all for the good and the glory of God. This is going to be an awesome time for us, brothers and sisters. So one spirit came forward, another spirit spoke in this manner, and they had different ideas. That's okay, they could have different ideas. But then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said to him, in what way? And he said, well, I'll go out, I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And the Lord said, go, yep, you persuade him. All right? And also prevail, go out and do so. And away that angel goes to take care of this mission. Brothers, this is going to be fun. This is going to be an awesome time to be a part of the heavenly council and join the angels in their work. This is fun times for us. This is not boring sit around. This is restored to youth, being with a group of people who brainstorm with you and come up with plans. And God says, that's a great idea. Go and do that. And he entrusts the angels to take care of that. And so there it is, that the Lord had put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets of yours because of that angel. And that's just fun to see that this is the heavenly council. In Genesis 1, remember when the angel said, let us make man in our image and according to our likeness and let him have dominion? And so God created man in verse 27, in his own image, in the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Can you imagine at that time when God gave the angels the authority to create this world? And they made all the different components of this world and they made man in their image. Male and female, he created them. Which, you know, somebody suggested to me at one point that maybe that is an indication that some of the angels just do have female characteristics like that. Because male and female, he made them. But what an opportunity to be a part of a group like this and actually make creations in other worlds and extend the family of God. These are the kind of things God has in store for those who love him and are incorporated into his family. This came up last night. Usually I cover it at this point in 1 Corinthians 11. I'll just give you some suggestions about why Paul says because of the angels. And just to warn you, in terms of like looking at, I'm a big person on context. Context, context, context. You'll notice the context of 1 Corinthians 11, when he brings this up, is man is not from woman, but woman from man. Well, when was that? All right, that's when the angels made Adam and they made Eve. Nor was man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. That's the original creation. The angels saw it wasn't good that the man be alone. And they decided to make woman for the man. But they took woman out of the man so that the man would be above the woman. They set the hierarchy. And they did it before Adam and Eve ever sinned. Oh, isn't that interesting in 1 Corinthians 11? Because somebody brought that up last night. But it's nothing to do with the sin. This was the hierarchy that was established before Adam and Eve ever had even sinned. And so Paul would say, look, don't disrupt the hierarchy that the creators of our creation put into place, because they did it all so that you would raise godly seed. So the kids would grow up understanding how this works. And they would realize in a godly family that these are the principles involved, so that our kids will learn to love our God and respect him and be a part of his family. So don't ruin that divine hierarchy. They set it all up. And that's why the woman has authority on her head, because of the angels. They were the ones who had made that decision. I don't think it's because the angels were just there in the ecclesia at that time. He's actually using the Paul's evidence that he builds is based on the original creation. Imagine the fun the angels had when the discussions that went on back when the Tower of Babel was going up there, when Johnny mentioned that to us, and I was sitting there thinking, you know, and here's the problem. You know, here they are. They're getting together, and they're going to come together, and they're going to work against God at this point. They're going to set up their whole other system of worship. Can you imagine the divine council at that point? God calls the angels in, says, what do you think we should do? And isn't that interesting? Now you can picture how this might play out. And an angel says one thing, an angel says another thing, and some other angel stands up and says, I know what we can do. We'll change their languages. And then they won't be able to communicate with each other. Go. And away they go. And so the Lord came down to see. That's fun to see that about the angels when they come down. They hear things. Cries go up to them, and God tells them things that are happening. And they come down to see because they don't have omnipresence. That's not something they have. They don't have that ability. They actually have to be there to see what's going on. So in verse 7, let us go down and confuse their language. And then the Lord scattered them abroad from there. But this was the work of the angels at this point, accomplishing this work and carrying out God's plan. In Exodus 23, this is a fun one to look at with Moses, because he said, look, I'm going to send an angel before you to keep you in the way. And you better obey his voice. Don't provoke him. You better not provoke this angel, for he will not pardon your transgressions, because my name is in him, the angel of his presence that he's referred to as. But if you obey his voice and do all that I speak, then he'll be an enemy. I'll be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you to bring you in with the Amorites and the Hittites and so on. Moses trusted this angel that was going to go with him, and he learned to develop a relationship with this angel, and he certainly revered him and feared him. Now, this is what Jesus would be referring to when he says, what's the big deal that you're worried about that I have the authority to forgive sins? If you read your Bibles carefully, you would have noticed that more than God has had the authority to forgive sins. He has entrusted others with this authority before. And this angel had that ability. See, he will not pardon your transgressions. He would hold them against them, or he could forgive them at that point. And Moses counted on that when he talked with that angel. There's a few other examples in there about the angel of the Lord, just the power and the authority of them when they went out and killed 185,000 that we looked at in 2 Kings 19. Daniel 4, we'll probably get to. You've already referred to the decree. It's interesting. It's not only just the decree of God, but Nebuchadnezzar realized that this was the decree of the watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, recognizing, probably with discussions with Daniel, that the angels were involved. He better know the angels were involved after he'd seen the angel walking amongst the three in the fiery furnace. Or in Acts 12 is another case about the authority of angels, when the angel struck Herod at that point when he didn't give God the glory. This is the kind of authority that God gives his angels. But although they have this authority, brothers and sisters, and although they have this high position, they never let it go to their heads. This is part of God's family. They always realize they're doing it for God. This is all about service to God. And so when it comes time to Revelation 19 or Revelation 22, when John would have a feeling about worshiping an angel when he saw what they were doing, they make it very clear, I'm just your fellow servant. They realize their position, and they never let it go to their heads. And this is something all of us have to keep in perspective as members of God's family. All we are is workers in God's family. We're just fellow servants with everyone else, as they made it very clear, even though they had such great power and authority. So some of the lessons for us today is that God certainly has empowered the angels with his awesome power. Let's respect them and cooperate with their work. Don't fight their work. Accept it, thank God for it, and cooperate. And let's be inquisitive, like angels do when they long to look into things and figure them out, and be excited about God's work today. They get excited. Imagine the angels, you know, controlling Iran right now and involving in the events that are happening in our world and what's going on. They're so excited because they know one of these things is going to bring about the end, and the kingdom will begin, and the beginning of a new age will start. Accept different rankings in life like the angels do. And it's going to be like that in the kingdom. We're not all going to be the top guy. And get used to that and just accept the fact that we are workers in God's family. We are fellow servants. And learn from the angels to suppress the pride and the selfishness that we might individually have. They do a perfect job of that. And we are now, brothers and sisters, training to be angels. And if this is the way it's going to work in God's family forever, then certainly today we need to practice living like angels so we can join them in their work forever. Thanks. I know there's a lot today. Thank you very much, and hopefully the rest of the week will be a little slower.